Jai Om Vishnupad, Paramahamsavara, Rajagachara, Sotera, Sri Shimla, Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Antakota Vaishnavinda ki jai, Namachara Shri Dastakura ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Samaveda Bhaktivrinda ki jai, Gaura Premananda, all glorious to some of the devotees, all glorious to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Sri Guranga. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vastaya Vidade Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Kanamani Namaste Sarasavade Gauravani Kacharni Nirvishesha Shunya Vadi Tashtachari Sakhani Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, so we're reading the Bhagavad Gita as it is by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We're reading chapter 12, texts 13 and 14, actually. Do this responsibly, since we have it on the board, just repeat the verses. Adveshta sarva bhutanam Maitrai karuna evacha Nirmamo nirahankara Samadukha sukha shami Santushta Satatam Yogi Yatatma Dridanishchaya Mayarpita Mano Buddhir Yomad Bhakta Samepriya. So we'll read the translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. One who is not envious, but is a kind friend to all living entities, who does not think himself a proprietor and is free from false ego, who is equal in both happiness and distress, who is tolerant, always satisfied, self-controlled, and engaged in devotional service with determination, his mind and intelligence fixed on me, such a devotee of mine is very dear to me. Report by Srila Prabhupada. Coming again to the point of pure devotional service, the Lord is describing the transcendental qualifications of a pure devotee in these two verses. A pure devotee is never disturbed in any circumstances, nor is he envious of anyone. Nor does a devotee become his enemy's enemy. He thinks, this person is acting as my enemy due to my own past misdeeds. So it is better to suffer than to protest. In the Srimad Bhagavatam 10.14.8, it is stated, Tate nukam pam su samikshamano Bhunjana Sivatma Pitam Vipakam. Whenever a devotee is in distress or has fallen to difficulty, he thinks that is the Lord's mercy upon him. He thinks, thanks to my own past misdeeds, I should suffer far, far greater than I am suffering now. So it is by the mercy of the Supreme Lord that I'm not getting all the punishment I'm due, I'm just getting a little by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, he is always calm, quiet, and patient despite many distressful conditions. A devotee is also always kind to everyone, even to his enemy. Nirmama means that a devotee does not attach much importance to the pains and trouble pertaining to the body because he knows perfectly well that he is not the material body. He does not identify with the body, therefore he is freed from the conception of false ego and is equipoised in happiness and distress. He is tolerant and he is satisfied that whatever comes by the grace of the Supreme Lord. He does not endeavor much to achieve something with great difficulty. Therefore, he is always joyful. He is a completely perfect mystic because he has fixed the instructions received from the spiritual master, and because his senses are controlled, he is determined. He is not swayed by false arguments because no one can lead him from the fixed determination of devotional service. He is fully conscious that Krishna is the eternal Lord, so no one can disturb him. All of these qualifications enable him to fix his mind and intelligence entirely on the Supreme Lord. Such a standard of devotional service is undoubtedly very rare, but a devotee becomes situated in that stage by following the regular principles of devotional service. Furthermore, the Lord says that such a devotee is very dear to him, for the Lord is always pleased with all of his activities in full Krishna consciousness. Om Jnana Kunandisha Gnajna Salakaya Chaksurun Mitamina Tasma Sri Gurave Namaha Panchakalpa Trubhischa Kripasindhubhyevicha Patitano Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. So, very nice verse in purport by Srila Prabhupada. I think I need to go a little bit back to the beginning of the first line of purport, where Srila Prabhupada says, coming again to the point of devotional service. So to put this in a little bit of context, this is a little summary of chapter 12. You'll remember that in the beginning of chapter 12, Arjuna asks Krishna, which is better, the impersonal or the personal understanding of the absolute truth? And Krishna confirms that this the superiority of devotional service, and says that those who worship the unmanifest, who worship Brahman, it is simply troublesome, and it's very, very difficult, and does not recommend that path. And then he goes through a series of verses where he sort of recommends what people can do to please him and to be engaged in Krishna consciousness. So he says first that one should fix one's mind firmly upon him, upon Krishna. But if one cannot do that, then one should follow the process of bhakti yoga, follow the regular principles of sadhana. And then if you can't do that, at least work for me. And if you can't do that, give up the results of your work. At least try to renounce your work, renounce the fruits of your labor. And if you can't do that, at least cultivate knowledge. Try to become a little bit knowledgeable. Raise up a little bit from the animal form of life into true human life. So now, after saying all that, then Krishna goes back to, but confirms that devotional service or bhakti yoga is the superior course. And so now what he's doing in these verses 13 and 14, he's talking about the qualities of one who is firmly fixed in bhakti yoga, of one who is a devotee of Krishna, one who is self-realized. So when he talks about these qualities, in the first line, the first thing that Krishna says is Advaishta Sarva Bhutanam. He says that the devotee is non-envious toward all living entities. So this is a very important quality, and Prabhupada goes on to explain this in the purport, how a devotee does not envy anyone else. In fact, he does not become the enemy of anybody else. It's described, actually there's one verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and there's other places, in reference to Maharaj Yudhisthira. Maharaj Yudhisthira is called Ajatashatru, which means one whose enemy was never born. Now that might seem a little strange, because we know that Maharaj Yudhisthira led the armies on the battle of Kurukshetra, where how many million? 18 million? And people were killed?
640 million.
Six, I was way off. 640 million. It was 18 days, 640 million. Okay. So his enemy was never born, but he was responsible for killing 640 million people. What that means is, he did not. Others may have chosen to become his enemy, but he never did. He always was equipoised towards everyone. He was always compassionate. He was always tolerant. He never took any personal offense, but he only did what he had to do on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So his enemy was never born. This is the nature of a devotee. It's not, and Prahlad Maharaj, of course, spoke about this. The materialistic person sees in terms of friends and enemies, but the devotee doesn't see this way. Devotee simply sees that there are conditioned living entities, and everyone needs the mercy and the compassion of the Lord. And in fact, this quality of not being envious is so important that Krishna gave that as the qualification of why he was imparting this knowledge of Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. In the first verse of the ninth chapter, Krishna says, "My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge." So he says he is anusuyave, one who is not envious. Now, this is a very special quality that the great devotees have, that they have this feeling of compassion, this feeling of not seeing anybody as a friend or an enemy particularly, but very equal to everyone. And, of course, I mentioned Prahlad Maharaj before. He was the epitome of this. And he exhibited this quality. Srila Prabhupada spoke about this a little bit in a lecture in Ahmedabad in 1972. Srila Prabhupada said, devotees, they are paradukaduki. The symptom of a devotee is they are unhappy by seeing others unhappy. Generally, a person, if he sees someone happy, he becomes unhappy. Matsaratha. That is the world situation. If I see my brother's very happy, he has improved his material condition, then I become unhappy. Therefore, spiritual advancement means persons who are not envious. Paramo nimatsaranam satam vatsavavastu vedyam. Bhagavatam 112. Matsara means envious. Nirmatsara, non-envious. This is the material condition that everyone is envious. Therefore, Krishna begins the Bhagavad Gita to get out of this ignorance and enviousness, and this is the basic principle of the Bhagavad Gita. So sometimes this is a little difficult to understand when we talk about envy, because many people say, well, I don't feel particularly envious. I'm not jealous of people. I'm pretty much okay if somebody has something. I don't envy that. And for the most part, that may be true. But we have to understand philosophically that original envy that is there in the living entity in this material world comes from our enviousness of God, our envious of Krishna. Because we wanted to have the position of God, the position of Krishna, who is the supreme enjoyer, the supreme controller, who is the supreme in everything, because we wanted that position, and you can't have that in the material world because the position's already taken. So we had to come into this material world to try to act as little gods, little Krishnas. I say act because we obviously can't succeed at it, but we make the attempt to try to, as Prabhupada would say, lord over material nature, to try to enjoy what we can in this little piece of the material world, whatever, you know, little bit of the material energy that I can take control of, that I can try to enjoy, and think that that is very wonderful and that we are happy doing this. Unfortunately, in doing so, it seems as though, although we know that Krishna says that he supplies all necessities to man when there is sacrifice for Vishnu, and of course when there is sacrifice for Vishnu, such as, I guess, throughout the Yatra festival, we get the rains that come, that make everything grow and are fertile. Now I realize it's also the time of year where we always get rains in Florida, but there still is some connection with the pious activity of the devotees and things coming about in this way. Even we were mentioning the vice mayor of Daytona Beach. I was speaking with him before we both had to speak yesterday at the program, and you know, he was actually very, very pious, and he really knew a lot. He had read a lot about the Festival of the Chariots, and you know, he really wanted to know about it, and he really had liked what he had heard and experienced from us. And I asked him, well, what problems do you have in the administration of Daytona Beach? He says, well, actually, one of the problems we have is that while there's an economic downturn, we're actually experiencing so much growth that we have to deal with. Things are going, you know, almost too well. And I said, well, you know, that may be because, you know, this is our sixth year bringing the Lord of the Universe to Daytona Beach. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things, well, why not? You know, this, you know, you might as well say it, you know, and because he was very friendly. I mean, I wouldn't have said it maybe to somebody else like that. And then when he gave his speech, he actually said that. He said, yeah, we were speaking, and he motioned to me, and he said, he suggested that, you know, that the what we're experiencing in Daytona Beach, he says, is due to the Lord of the Universe, you know, coming and seeing us all. And he says, you know, I think that's probably true. I believe that. You know, of course, he's a politician, but he didn't have to say that. In other words, you know, he said that, so even he was recognizing, you know, that when one does serve God, then good things happen. Auspiciousness comes about. So while that's there, when people don't understand that, they think good things come about because of their own endeavor, because of my work and what I achieve, and sometimes I have to step on other people to get what I want. You know, business is cutthroat, it's dog eats dog, or all those expressions they have, and therefore people become very envious of one another. This person has more than me, I need to somehow succeed more, or you know, how did he get that, I deserve that, what did they ever do? You know, so many thoughts are there. And in fact, we even have to be very careful as devotees that we don't become envious. Why does this person have this position? You know, what do they do? How come he's being honored or whatever like that? You know, it's really not part of devotee consciousness. So we want to be very wary of that and not become part of that. But we do, but because of the envious, we sometimes feel that we are wronged by others. We feel that something has happened to me and it's somebody's fault. We probably have all experienced that. You know, and sometimes there does seem to be a very strong causal effect, cause and effect, that yes, this person did something and it caused me some difficulty. And that's what Srila Prabhupada is speaking about in the first part of the purport. He says a pure devotee is never disturbed in any circumstances. He doesn't say this person is acting as my enemy. He said it's due to my own past misdeeds. So it's better to suffer than to protest. Now this is, of course, sometimes a very difficult thing to do. You know, the turn your other cheek is the Christian expression of it, to try to simply see. But it's not just a matter of, well, I'm going to be a good person and therefore I'll be forgiving. It's actually a deeper realization. It's a deeper philosophical realization that actually nothing comes about by chance. Nothing is simply circumstance. Nothing is happening by the whims of whatever, you know, that are out there. But that actually everything is purposeful. There is cause and effect in the universe. There's the laws of karma. You know, if something is happening to me, that some distress, some suffering, then I did something this lifetime or some past lifetime that I may not even be aware of that has brought about this reaction. So if someone is causing me some suffering, perhaps I caused that person suffering, either in this lifetime or in a past lifetime, which I may not even remember. And therefore, why should I be angry at them? Why should I retaliate and simply perpetuate the cycle of suffering, perpetuate the cycle of karma? Because if somebody does hurt you in some way by the laws of karma, you can hurt them later in the next lifetime. But think about what a futile cycle that is. And that's how, you know, we have, so it can even be on a larger scale. One country insults another country or does something or takes our land, so therefore we fight them. We have a war. And because we do something to them, then they can do something back to us. And so you see this karmic progression goes on and on without stop. It goes on in individuals. It goes on in nations. It goes on between religions. And, you know, there's simply this, this fighting, enviousness, bickering, warfare at worst. And there's no real solution. So the devotee takes a different attitude. Says, all right, perhaps someone has wronged me. Perhaps I'm suffering. It is simply due to my own activities, and I'm not going to be overly concerned. And Srila Prabhupada quotes this wonderful prayer by Lord Brahma in 10.14a. This is, of course, at the end of the Brahma Vimoha Lila, where Lord Brahma is bewildered by Krishna when he steals his cows and his and the coward boys. Anyway, we're back on. Anyway, at the end of that, I can speak loudly. At the end of that, Brahma is feeling very remorseful, and he goes and he offers prayers to Lord Krishna because he realized he tried to play a trick on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and in fact, of course, he got tricked even more so himself. And Krishna completely bewildered him and overwhelmed him with his own yogic mystic powers. So now Brahma's offering prayers to Krishna. And he's feeling a little contrite. He's feeling a little sorry that I tried to do this, you know, and I had no right to do so. Now I've come to my senses. And so in that 8th chapter of the, the 14th chapter of the 10th canto, there's many, many famous prayers that Lord Brahma offers that are very, very wonderful to read. And of course, this is probably one of his most famous. Tate nukam pamna samikshamano bhujjana ibatma kritam vipakam vidpag vipur vir vidaram namaste jiveta yo mukti pade siddhayabhak. My dear Lord, one who earnestly awaits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds, and offering your respectful obeisances with his heart, words, and body, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim. So here we see such a profound, such a deep realization, understanding by a pure devotee of the Lord. Of course, Lord Brahma is now reinstated in his situation, no longer covered over. And he is understanding that, first of all, Krishna's greatness. He's understanding that that the devotee simply waits for the mercy of the Lord, And if one does not seem to be receiving that mercy, if one is experiencing some suffering, he patiently suffers that reaction, understanding that it's from one's own misdeeds, and he continues to offer respect, faith, love, and devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, understanding that eventually he will achieve liberation, or eventually one will become completely purified and free from all those material misgivings within the heart, and will come to the stage of pure love of God. So the Vedic literature gives us a very clear view on what suffering means, and why suffering may be there, and why suffering is part of the material world, and a clear path of bhakti yoga, a clear path of devotional service, how we can overcome the material suffering. But this, of course, is not something that has been understood by many people throughout history. And many, many people have, and different philosophers have even tried to talk about suffering, understand why there is this misery in the material world. Even people who believe in God or understand God don't know why God creates suffering. Why is there misery in this material world? There's been so much different philosophy based upon that. Of course, some people... Can everybody hear me, by the way?
Yes. Yes. Oh,
thank you. Probably just my voice is shouting. But... Of course, we have those who simply try to ignore the idea of suffering. There's so many expressions that you use. Stop and smell the roses. Enjoy every moment. Go for the gusto. Those are advertising slogans. You only go around once. Somebody advertised that. Talk about ignorance. This is kind of the ostrich philosophy. In other words, we don't know what's going on. We don't understand why we're in this world. Sure, there's a lot of suffering, but just try to enjoy whatever you can. Try to ignore it. And just, look at the bright side. It sounds nice, but it's actually fairly ignorant. It's really just a way of avoiding the real problems, which are birth, death, disease, and old age. Of course, others see that suffering is just part of the cruel joke, that there's no meaning to life. Bertrand Russell, who was a famous philosopher in the 20th century, he said, "In the part of this universe that we know, there's great injustice, and often the good suffer, and often the wicked prosper, and one hardly knows which of those is the more annoying." So, a bit humorous, but in other words, if we don't know why there's suffering, why there's happiness, and why it doesn't seem to be fair. Of course, others try to find some value, think that there must be some plan, maybe God has some plan, that suffering is good for the soul, that kind of develops character. There's a little bit to that, but it needs a little bit more depth of understanding. Here's a couple of quotes. Helen Keller said, "Character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, ambition inspired, and success achieved." Interesting. And there's a Greek proverb that says, "He who suffers much will know much." Now, there's a certain degree of truth to that, but in itself, it doesn't really give us enough. Because suffering alone does not bring about wisdom or knowledge. Many people suffer without knowledge. They suffer needlessly, suffer for no reason, without any meaning or benefit in their life. So if one is intelligent, suffering may be a cause of understanding greater depth, of philosophical thinking. So suffering can have that value. But if it only leads to one being miserable, it doesn't really have that particular value. Because there also must be spiritual knowledge that one is cultivating. And then, of course, there are those who think, well, suffering is simply an illusion. The Maya bodies or the Buddhists or the Voidists sometimes think, well, suffering is just a creation of the mind. The Dalai Lama said, the basic thing is that everyone wants happiness, no one wants suffering. And happiness mainly comes from our own attitude rather than external factors. If our own mental attitude is correct, even if you remain in a hostile atmosphere, you feel happy. There again, that's half truth. Yes, it is. The suffering is mostly in the mind. But it's not simply a matter of having a happy attitude. There used to be this is probably about two generations ago, I don't know when it was, way back in the 40s or 50s. Who wrote the book of Power of Positive Thinking? Dale Carnegie? Who is it?
Norman Vincent Peale.
Thank you. Power of Positive Thinking. mean, this was a, you know, there's always been this philosophy. You'll find this different versions of this. It's probably, I'm sure there's a 2014 version of the same philosophy. You know, if you think positive things, you know, if you think positively, positive things will happen. Well, you know, that only goes so far. And, you know, because, you know, if your karma is such that positive things aren't going to happen, they're probably not going to happen unless you make the major shift in your life. And you can't really just think happy thoughts and everything will be happy in your life. So, the Vedic literature give us an understanding of suffering and the relief of suffering. So this reality of the material world, nobody wants suffering but it comes. And understanding the nature of suffering in the material world is considered to be one of the processes or one of the symptoms of knowledge, which is given in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. The symptoms of the evils of birth, death, and disease, and old age. This is a symptom of knowledge. So we know that suffering will come on its own accord, due to the laws of nature and kind of karma, and happiness will also come on its own accord. But the devotee understands this is not our true nature. This is the material world. This is the world that we are meant to get out of. This is the condition that we are taking up spiritual life, taking up self-realization so that we can get out of the situation of misery and suffering. It's not that we are pessimistic and just say everything is miserable. No, we say there is happiness. There is real spiritual happiness. And that can easily be gotten by the living entity, by the very easy process of saying Hare Krishna and taking up devotional service. So through knowledge, the devotee does not experience material suffering the same way as before we were devotees, because we understand that we are not the body, and as the attachment to the body and the mind lessens, there's a qualitative different experience. It's not that we no longer are experiencing or feeling some pain to the body, but we understand it in a different way. We don't take it that this is me, this is the destruction of myself, my body is experiencing some great suffering or some difficulty, even up to the point of some chronic illness or even up to the point of death. The devotee understands, this is not my real self. I am the spirit soul that is within this body, who has an eternal relationship with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that is my real life. What's happening with the body and the mind, yes, it may cause some distress, it may cause some suffering, but I don't identify that as the self. And therefore, one can experience a great relief of suffering. In fact, in the symptoms of devotional service, one of the first symptoms that one experiences is a relief from the suffering of the material world. Devotee experiences, even in the beginning stage of Krishna consciousness. So, in contrast, the spiritual happiness that we experience is based upon our relationship with Krishna. That relationship with Krishna is reawakening by the process of bhakti yoga. When we take up Krishna consciousness, we take up real spiritual life under the orders of the spiritual master, following instructions of Srila Prabhupada, then immediately we come to a stage where we start to feel some relief of that suffering, not just in a negative way, but in the positive way that we're experiencing the higher phase of Krishna consciousness. We're experiencing a spiritual happiness, a spiritual bliss, which is far beyond anything that we experience in the material world. And so therefore, one experiences that real satisfaction of spiritual happiness is the satisfaction of the soul. The satisfaction of our real self. It is who we are. The real self, once again, reuniting in relationship of love and service with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is what gives total satisfaction to the living entity, to all of us. And therefore, that happiness is greater than any suffering that's there in the material world, and it's greater than any happiness that is there in the material world. So, along with this, with the experience of happiness experienced by devotees, one does not need to maintain envy in one's heart towards any other living entity. Why should one feel any envy? Because one is self-satisfied. The devotee of Atmarama becomes self-satisfied in the relationship with Krishna. So that inner self-satisfaction means you don't need to worry so much if someone is causing you distress, if there is some suffering. So the opposite of that envy is to have a sense of love and compassion towards all living entities. To want to see that everyone is happy and everyone is given the highest thing in this world, which is Krishna consciousness. So if we have that opportunity to give the chanting of the holy name, to give our sanctified sutras, to give prasadam, to give this philosophy of Bhagavad Gita to others, to introduce people to the spiritual master, to Srila Prabhupada, somebody who can guide them in spiritual life, then that, by seeing the happiness that that can create in another human being, in another person, that gives the inner happiness and satisfaction to the devotee. And that's why the devotee, as Srila Prabhupada said, has this quality that they are only unhappy, that they are only unhappy when others are unhappy. And if we can give God consciousness, spiritual life to another living entity, then that is our greatest happiness. And I think when we have these wonderful events of these Ravyatris, one of the reasons why it's just so pleasing to the devotees, of course we're bringing out the Lord of the universe and serving Lord Jagannath Balaram Subhadra so nicely. And of course that in itself is satisfying that we are able to give that service. But the very special nature of that service is that it's exactly Lord Jagannath's pastime, that he comes out of the temple and makes himself out to be seen by all the living entities. And we were reading yesterday the great benefit that one who actually sees the Prabhupada said, one who sees Lord Jagannath does not see birth and death in this material world again. So the ability to be able to give or to bring, to help facilitate Lord Jagannath appearing before so many people, and to hear the holy name, to hear God, the sankirtan that is going on, thinking to God and saying, this is very satisfying to devotees and very, very wonderful. And that is what gives us their happiness. And if we remain in that consciousness, and we remain, and that is what we absorb ourselves in, then there's no room, not only for worrying about ourselves and our own sufferings and our own difficulties, there's certainly no room for enviousness of others. And therefore, we become more and more advanced in the Christian consciousness. And that in itself becomes very, very pleasing to the spiritual master. When you pick up this message of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is telling us, it's interesting that this series of this verse from text 14 to the end, 14 through 20, to the end of the Bhagavad Gita, every line ends pretty much the same, doesn't it? With the same one who the devotee is very dear to. There's little different versions of it. This last line is Yomabhakta Same Priya. So that's repeated in the next six verses, or a close version of that same line. And so by taking up these qualities of the devotee, this is how one becomes very dear to Krishna, and that's the perfection of one's life. So thank you very much. All glories to the Prabhupada. We might have a couple minutes for questions.
Dhammapada Prabhupada says in the purport that a devotee is always kind to everyone, even to his enemy. That sounds so noble. I wonder what that looks like. Could you give an example of being kind? How could you be kind to an enemy?
There's some very good examples of this. Oh, I'm sorry. We don't have time. The question was, Prabhupada says that one is kind even towards one's enemy, and that sounds very noble, but how do we really see examples of this? I think that was the question. Of course, we do see in Srimad Bhagavatam examples of like Ambarish Maharaj, who, Dhruva Maharaj was going to kill him.
Yeah,
Ambarish, Dhruvasa Muni was going to, kill him in practice, some slight offense, and of course he did no offense whatsoever. In fact, he was almost apologizing and began convenience to him and caused some offense. And of course we see Prahlad Maharaj being a wonderful example of that. When Lord Shingdev asked him for some boon, for some benediction, he said, I want nothing for myself. That my only concern is for those fools and rascals who are subject to the material world. And Lord Shingdev said, well, please ask, you must take something. He said, all right, the only thing that I ask for is that you liberate my father. And of course, his father tried to kill him in so many ways. Certainly was his enemy, we could say. But his mood towards him was simply one of forgiveness and one that he would somehow become liberated and have a chance to have devotional service to Krishna. That's it?
Lord Nityananda.
Lord Nityananda, how can we give a wonderful example? Jagannatha attacked him as he was trying to give him spiritual knowledge. His head was bleeding. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came with his Shuddhi Chanchakra, ready to kill Madai. And Lord Nityananda said, no, this is not our purpose. If you come to kill all the demons, you'd have to kill everyone. So your purpose is to liberate, to save, to give them your mercy. Lord Chaitanya said, yes, you are right. And so the mercy was given due to the mercy of Lord Nityananda and his forgiveness. So we can see many, many examples of his forgiving. Haridas Thakur, he was beaten in 22. Thank you for your help with the numbers here. Good luck with them today. 22 marketplaces. And they were supposed to kill him, but he wouldn't die. Because of being protected by Krishna, by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they couldn't kill him. And so therefore, finally he realized,
they were in great distress. The people of Eden said, we're going to be in big trouble because we're supposed to kill you, and, you know, you won't die. He said, oh, I'm sorry. And so he more or less feigned that he had died, and so, of course, he didn't really. And, you know, because he felt merciful to them because they were going to get in trouble for trying to kill him and being unsuccessful. So, you know, we see these incredible examples in Chaitanya Leela and through, and obviously throughout the whole Srimad Bhagavatam, of devotees who exhibited this, where they had absolutely no animosity towards those who maybe tormented them or even tried to kill them or to harm them in so many ways, but rather were only looking out for their welfare. And I'm sure there are many modern examples that, probably don't see them quite as frequently amongst themselves, not being as advanced devotees. But does anyone think of a more recent example?
In 1990, a gentleman, some devotees were seen by a guy who was so envious of Bihara Krishna. He took a machete and ran them down.
You think of what?
A machete.
Machete.
He took a picture of me. And they had a certain newspaper, Hare Krishna man, this Hare Krishna man, that all those things. On Friday, this Friday, I set up a program in Trinidad. This guy ended up going there. And what I get to understand, this man chanted Hare Krishna with the devotees. So I realized Krishna was forgive everybody.
So I'm saying that this was a man who attacked the devotees with a machete. Now he's becoming a devotee.
Yeah.
But
no one chanted the Arab with the devotee chant.
Yeah. How
did they? What is the point when we understand and we hear even in the Bible when Jesus says turn the other cheek? What is the point when you're like a doormat? In other words, people are stepping all over. The weakness in some cases by some people can see, humility can be seen as a weakness.
Well, yes, Arjuna took a very humble position, right? In the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, beginning the battle with Kurukshetra, and he said, he wanted to take a more noble, advanced path, and Krishna said, no, your job is to fight and kill all those many millions of people. I can never remember the number. So, I think the simple answer, although it's actually a very deep question, it's a very complex question, a very good question, I think the simple answer is it depends upon one's service to the Lord. In other words, if for oneself, one can be very humble. But for the protection of Krishna's devotees, the deities, for Krishna, one can become very assertive, even aggressive. Just as we saw Arjuna fighting on the battle of Kurukshetra. And that was under Krishna's direct order. And certainly, Krishna said, don't become a doormat. He said, he told him exactly the opposite thing. So I think it's a matter of, am I protecting the devotees by protecting his spiritual master, by protecting Krishna, or is it simply for myself? Now, realistically, of course, the tendency to protect one's own body is natural. That's actually mentioned in the scriptures, that's a natural tendency, but I think the greater point here, not necessarily somebody who's attacking you, with a knife or a gun and would you defend yourself, but it's more if someone is causing you distress, if someone were, blaspheming or, saying, in other words, the idea is that the devotee wouldn't unnecessarily or unduly, take great